Thanks, Nathan, and welcome back. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. It's the final weekend of the Olympics. Black athletes have been particularly significant to the storylines in Rio, from Simone Biles record-tying 4 gold medals to Simone Manuel's precedent-breaking gold and silver medals in swimming. Breonna Rollins, Nia Ali, and Christy Caslin captured the first-ever medal sweep in the 100-meter hurdles, and Ashley Johnson is the standout goalie as the women's water polo team heads into the gold medal game today against Italy. How do the achievements of these gifted young people inform the larger implications for the conversation about race in America? Let's take up that question in this edition of Culture Connections with Dr. Sherry Parks. She's an Associate Dean for Research, Interdisciplinary Scholarship and Programming at the College of Arts and Humanities at the University of Maryland College Park, where she's also an Associate Professor in the Department of American Studies, and she's the author of Fierce Angels, Living with a Legacy from the Sacred Dark Feminine to the Strong Black Woman. Morning, Sherry. Good to see you.
Good morning. Good to see you.
So before we take up the Olympics, you live in Oella. We were just talking Howard County Executive Alan Kittleman. You were right next to this devastation.
Yeah, the next street over on another hill. So we were quite safe. But it is really, for us, a statement about place and space, because, I mean, the people in my office start hinting for chocolates from Sweet Cascades in October, because I buy the chocolate turtles, and my wedding reception was at Coco Lane. And so it was interesting to hear you ask the question about, well, why rebuild it? And the answer was very emotional. And it is a very special place. All the shops are non-essential, meaning that, you know, nobody lives or dies based on the products that are there. Mm-hmm. But it really is, in some ways, the heart of that little region there.
Yeah, but you got to wonder, though, with this repeated devastation that happens, you know, sort of every few years, so I think there's growing concern that, does it make sense to rebuild what was there, or, you know, redevelop that area into some other kind of thing, just because the floods are just, you know, sort of part and parcel of what that area is about.
Well, for me, it brings home, literally brings home, this question about global warming, because we're going to get more and more of those. And I'm watching the news stories in New Orleans and other Baton Rouge and other places, knowing that we've got to figure out what to do with our relationship with water.
Yeah.
And this is our conversation in Maryland.
Yeah. Well, it's quite a conversation. And of course, what's going on over there is, caught the attention of the entire country for sure. And then it's followed up with, what's going on now in Baton Rouge. But let's move to the Olympics. The coverage of the games is actually drawing smaller audiences in terms of the TV audiences than it has in the past, although they're still wiping out all the other networks while they're on. But it's because people are watching in podcasts and stuff. But it does seem that an awful lot of people are seeing an incredible array of terrific African-American athletes doing just amazing things, and sometimes doing things in sports that they're not normally associated with, fencing and mm-hmm. swimming and, stuff like that. What has this changed, do you think, or will it change the way we talk about race in America, given that this is such a central event?
Well, I think they are exploding some myths about black bodies, some things that were considered truisms. Black people can't swim, they'll sink. Which is still floating around out there if you watch what's going on social media. And so winning gold medals kind of explodes that. And fencing, I should say truth, and I fenced for Chapel Hill mm-hmm. in undergraduate.
Yes. So,
and I was one of the few black people out there. But so watching people win in fencing has been particularly wonderful. But I also think, in terms of that, I mean, you've got your first, and you're going to continue to get your first in that. In many cases, the swimming and the fencing are statements about social class. I mean, who now has access to pools? I have my roommate at Chapel Hill's father, who is African American, his father died by drowning. And African Americans actually
in a pool.
Do die more in drowning. But because of that, she made sure in her actually upper middle class life that all of her children went to swimming lessons, joined a pool, because often that's where the best coaches are. And her son is a good enough swimmer that he actually swam for Chapel Hill.
Wow.
So it's not body mass, it's social class. But the other thing that is happening, you know, the Olympics are an exercise in nationalism. I mean, you fly the flag and athletes are draped in the American flag when they win. And we've seen an awful lot of that, of African-Americans draped in the American flag, you know, the women's 100-meter hurdles.
Yeah, all three of them. Gold, of them, medal, gold, silver, and bronze.
Terrific. Jumping in the air with their flags, and so they're literally flying the flag. And it's very interesting that they have been embraced, at least for now, because of that.
Simone Biles,
yes,
who is just this singular phenomenon, came in and everybody really just assumed she would win all five gold medals, mm-hmm, in all five events that she entered. That turned out not to be quite the case, but she won the bronze medal on the balance beam, even though she had a slip.
Yeah,
so
her score was so high.
It was that good that you could even just sort of, you know, right, have a crash and burn moment for most people, and she wins a bronze medal.
And that was the dramatic moment, is that she didn't win the gold.
Yeah, yeah. What happens with a figure like that? I mean, she's obviously turned pro. She's getting some endorsements. I suppose perhaps will the number and dollar amount of the endorsements that she takes in, will that be an indication of her acceptance? And I wonder if that will indicate some, you know, some increased empathy for African Americans or increased you know, affection.
Two interesting questions in there. There's a two-step process, maybe, because the endorsements are not a direct indication. They are a direct indication of the corporate anticipation of her acceptance. And so there's a step, and sometimes they miss and sometimes they hit. And I have to say that traditionally African-American athletes get fewer endorsements and for less money than other athletes. And so that has been the case. Whether she transcends that, we will see. She transcends racialism in some ways, you know, her big, very publicized crush on Zac Efron and the hug and all of that already transcends. She's very perky. She doesn't act in or speak in ways that many people in America would perceive as stereotypically Black. Whether that lasts over time, her popularity is interesting, because gymnasts are a particular breed in terms of their appeal to the public. So there's race, there's her African-Americanism. I think if anybody has a chance, she does, because she's so, and I'm going to use this word and it's loaded, exceptional, because there is the danger of stepping into the exceptional Negro category of it's just her.
Hmm. Yeah, so she is such a singular figure that it is not indicative by any means. Yeah,
well,
interesting.
The word that follows her often is superhuman, that she's not quite of us. And so that way she's not she may not be seen as representing Black people.
For all of these athletes, Simone Biles, Simone Manuel, this incredible swimmer, Ashley Johnson, this goalie for the water polo team, she's incredible. I wonder how our understanding and appreciation of their accomplishments is going to be understood in light of the fact that we had four white swimmers just yesterday be exposed as complete creeps.
Well,
Ryan Lochte et al. Making up stories, indicting the security situation in Rio to cover up you know, boorish actions of their own.
Well, the Root, which is an arm of the Washington Post, has already run a story saying that was an exercise in white privilege, of them feeling that they could behave any way they wanted to in this majority Black country. And I think I'm sorry that story has pushed off the happier stories. I mean, we in Maryland have lots of happy Olympic stories. I mean, Maryland did really well.
Yeah.
And is still doing really well. And so I think that the fact that story can push their story off is indicative of how the media is going to handle it. I mean, what are you going to remember longer? And that story is going to have legs because it's not over yet.
Yeah. On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. It's our Culture Connections segment with Dr. Sherry Parks from the University of Maryland. You wrote a terrific book called Fierce Angels, about strong Black women. This has been about strong black women, hasn't it?
Well, and that is how the women are being portrayed. I mean, Simone Biles, there's already a Tide commercial that has her, you know, kind of conquering her environment all over the place. And the way the goalie has been described as exploding out of the goalpost. And so there's lots of indication. You know, with Simone Manuel, it was very interesting because nobody was talking about her during the competition. I kept saying that black woman over on the side seems to be swimming faster than the other people, but the commentators didn't say anything until she actually won, and so now she's the champion.
Yeah.
But before, they were talking about everybody else. But certainly, over and over, this idea of black women as stronger has been throughout the Olympics. Now, Simone is interesting because she's strong and little and perky, and you know,
she's the whole package, isn't she? Yeah.
You know, and so I think the image of black women who are strong and is a very interesting one for the Olympics.
Gabby Douglas,
yes.
Who many people felt just awful for. She's a defending gold medal champion from the London Olympics, not even allowed to compete in the all-around event. I mean, just because she didn't make the cut this year. 4 years can be a lifetime, I suppose, in the sport of gymnasts. But she's been widely criticized for a brief moment in which she did not choose to place her hand over her heart during the playing of the national anthem. What do you make
and
of that?
When did the rule that you had to put your hand over your heart come? And actually, the women's hurdle team, none of them put their hands over their heart. And I haven't heard any backlash about that. Gabby Douglas was in a very difficult situation in that she's still quite good. And the U.S. gymnastics team is so good that we left people at home that would have beat many of the other teams. And so her being just the third one meant that she was still better than a lot of the people that she had to sit and watch. That's tough.
Yeah.
That's very tough. And I think she handled it the best way a 20-year-old could have handled it. She was there. She smiled as much as she could. I mean, was she jumping up and down as much as other people? No. Unfortunately, Krabby rhymes with Gabby.
Yeah. She was, you know, the sort of Simone Biles of the London Olympics in a
yes.
way, but she and they do share some things, but Simone Biles is a different personality than Gabby Douglas. Gabby's always been a little more introspective, a little quieter, it seems to me.
Well, and Simone comes from more privilege than Gabby, and that I think is really important. She acts in ways that mainstream America can understand. The follow-up act, and you know this as a performer, the follow-up act after a hit is always the hardest.
Yeah, indeed. Let's talk about Simone Biles' background. I mean, it was privileged at some point, but early on, it certainly was not.
Right.
How does that play into the narrative of how we understand?
Well, you know, we always love up from stories, and at first, we didn't know the story about her mother and her behavior, and that Simone and her sister were given to her grandfather to raise, and he's where the privilege comes in, and the education, and even the homeschooling, which requires a certain amount of leisure to homeschool a child so she can be a gymnast. And so, but then that just only adds because she's already overcome that background. She's already heroic. And so it adds to the story because we love those up from poverty, up from suffering stories.
On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. My guest, Dr. Sherry Parks. It's our Culture Connections segment. Last night, another precedent-breaking gentleman left the airwaves, Larry Wilmore, who mm-hmm. started as the host of The Nightly Show, which was replacing Stephen Colbert's show when he departed Comedy Central to go and take over Letterman's spot on CBS. They sort of abruptly canceled him. He was, at that time, the first African-American late-night host. He was the oldest of the crop of late-night hosts. I did not see the episode last night, but what do you make of Larry Wilmore's tenure at Comedy Central, and what does it mean that he had that position, and what does it mean that he does not have that position now, for whatever their reasons were?
Well, first we have to remember Arsenio Hall.
Arsenio Hall, right.
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 So he wasn't the first, but he's the first in a long time and the only. Late night is a very interesting television relationship. People are starting to go to bed. They have a relationship with that guy that comes on every night before they go to bed. You can be funny and you can be edgy, but you also have to be warm. He's not warm. And so here was this intelligent, hard-hitting black guy.
Let's listen to a little clip from last night's show, the last episode of Nightly with Larry Wilmore, and his guest was Jon Stewart.
You gave voice to underserved voices in the media arena. You started a conversation that was not on television when you began. And you worked with a group of people who you invited to that conversation to collaborate with you, to sharpen that conversation. And what you don't realize is you walk out of this room and that conversation doesn't end.
We can hope, you know.
And I'm really,
we can hope that conversation doesn't end, but I wonder, you know, once you take the African-American out of the host seat, it doesn't help the conversation.
Well, I'm really glad that you ran that clip because I think John Stewart has a point that you may not see it as hard-hitting, but television often imitates itself. And so there's been this process where there was this hard-hitting show, then there was the White House Correspondents' Dinner that introduced him to a broader audience. His audience really should be younger than I think he hits. And those people don't.
And that's the reason they're giving for canceling him, is that it wasn't resonating with our audience,
right,
which tends to be younger males. I wonder if they're mostly white males. I don't know.
Well, that's who Jon Stewart's audience is.
Yeah.
But I think television will then come and imitate parts of it in a looser, lighter way. And so it may reverberate. I think that's what Jon Stewart's talking about. It may reverberate that way. I don't think anybody's going to dare to come back as and hit as hard as he did. I have very mixed feelings about him, actually.
White House Correspondents' Dinner, we just got a few seconds left. He dropped the N-word in a loving way to President Obama. Do you think that kind of, you know, really on-the-edge performance affected people's understanding and appreciation of him on television on a regular basis?
Yes. I think it eclipsed some of his stronger, more truthful messages.
Yeah, interesting. Well, Sherry, always good to see you. We shall see you the next time.
Okay.
Dr. Sherry Parks is an Associate Dean for Research Interdisciplinary Scholarship. I can't say that we're going to. Interdisciplinary Scholarship. I'm glad I don't have your calling card, and programming at the College of Arts and Humanities at the University of Maryland College Park. She's also an associate professor in the Department of American Studies. She's the author of Fierce Angels, Living with a Legacy from the Sacred Dark Feminine to the Strong Black Woman. Coming up after a break for the news, a new whiskey has made its way to the shelves of local spirit shops. It's made by two new whiskey wizards. We'll meet them coming up later on Maryland Morning. But first, here's a Baltimore story with Gil Sandler.